Accession number 4784, Reel 2.
Reverend Sandesh, Reel 2. Before we go on to the internment period, were there any particular incidents in the battle for Hong Kong that you especially remember?
Perhaps I should begin by saying that the Japanese attack started at first light on the 8th of December. It came into what we call the New Territories area, because that's the area running right up to the Chinese border. In 4 days, and our main defense lines were there, the Japanese had breached those defense lines and were in control of the whole of the Kowloon area. On, the fourth day, they sent a peace mission over, and they said to Governor, I suppose, and Commander-in-Chief, look, your situation's hopeless, you must know it. To save destruction of life and property, surrender. The peace mission was rejected out of hand, and they went back again in not very good tempers.
Tell me a little more about the problems with which you were confronted at the Memorial Hospital in the closing stages of the battle for Hong Kong.
To answer that question, I'd better go on to Christmas Day. Or perhaps, shall I say first of all, that after taking over the hospital, I established myself in the hospital office as a command post. I was in touch with the hospital through their loudspeaker system, so I could talk to everybody. Fortunately, they knew me. They knew my voice because I'd been broadcasting regularly on Radio Hong Kong for a number of years. And I was well known in the colony. So people responded, and we got some sort of order into the hospital, ready for the finale, which started at first light on Christmas Day. By that time, the Japanese were in occupation of pretty well everywhere, except the peak area of the colony. That's where the hospital was, and there were still areas there holding out. And from first light Christmas Day through the rest of the day, they just pounded that area mercilessly. And although the hospital was well marked as such with Red Cross signs, which couldn't be mistaken, it brought us no relief at all. Now, that was a four-story building. The two upper stories were soon in danger of being reduced to a shambles. So I got everybody out of those two upper stories, first of all into the basement, which was below ground and very safe, and then onto the first floor, which was surrounded with thick granite walls, and the shells that were hitting us, fortunately, didn't penetrate, they bounced off. But there we were, on those two floors, with our heads down, and all hell going on outside. The noise was terrific. Consequently, of course, with a hospital full of people, we had hysteria. I spent a lot of my time going round trying to comfort people, trying to calm them. And then at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, just like that, there came a strange lull and calm. I was in the hospital office at the time, and I instinctively looked out of the window. I only realized at that moment that that window looked out onto what was called Gough Hill Police Station, one of the main police posts of the colony. And whilst I was actually looking through that window, I saw the white flag slowly climbing the flagpole at Gough Hill. And I thought, that's why. We've surrendered. And I found myself, no.
It was hard to believe that you
Even though we should have known. I mean, our position was helpless from the very first hour. With our meagre resources, how could we cope with Japan, who had an army of 80,000 men across the border?
So why was it such a shock, such a surprise?
Because you can't get yourself to believe that you're going to be annihilated and taken prisoner. It's something somehow which only comes gradually.
How do you spell Gough? Gough Hill?
G-O-U-G-H.
Thank you.
G-O-U-G-H. Mm. Well, now, to go back there, just while I was in that moment of, shock, I suppose, the telephone rang. I picked up the phone, and it was a message from command headquarters. And it so happened I knew the voice. He was an officer friend of mine. And he said, "Well, Ernest, I've got to tell you that we've surrendered." I said, I already know. I've just seen the white flag go up. So he said, "Well, this is it. This will be the last communication that I shall be able to have with you. I can't give you any more advice. You're on your own from now on. The Japanese will be sending a takeover party sooner or later. They'll be flushed with victory when they come. Be careful how you deal with them. Be careful how you handle them. And that's it." And then he said, "Well, goodbye and good luck." And finally, I remember him saying, "We'll meet again someday." And by Jove, we did.
And what happened?
Not until 5 years later.
Yes, and did this Japanese occupation party quickly arrive?
Perhaps I can go on to say just what happened. When I pulled myself together, of course, I announced this to the hospital. And, of course, everybody was shattered, just as I was, absolutely shattered. And I had to talk to them. I said, "Well, do remember that we've nothing to be ashamed of. We've had a hopeless task from the beginning, but we've done it. We've stuck to it till the very end, which is now." So, with true British dignity and fortitude, let's face the future, whatever it's going to be and wherever it's going to be. So, first of all, let everybody get something to eat. We have plenty of food here, thank God. And we've had nothing to eat since morning. We've had no time. Let everybody get a good meal. When that's over, I'll go to the hospital entrance and wait for the coming of the takeover party. You stay here and keep your heads down and behave yourselves. And that's what we did. And I waited well into the night. And then I saw them coming. A group of officers with a bodyguard. The hospital's on a hill. It commands the road leading up to it. And as they came up to the... I can see it now. As they came up to the hospital entrance, I went out to meet them. I've got to say that they dealt with me very courteously, brusquely, of course. The command was able English. He told me the hospital. I did, and we went into the office. There was a table and chairs there. The officer sat on one side of the table with the bodyguard behind them, armed to the teeth. I sat alone on this side of the table and waited for him to tell me what he'd come to say. Mm-hmm. Well, now, just while he was talking, there were sounds from the hospital itself indicating to me that they were brewing up, getting tea ready. The officer was alarmed, and he rapped out, "What's that? What's that? What's happening?" I said, "It's quite all right. They're just brewing tea. Then now listen to this. I don't know what to think about this." Quite spontaneously, without thinking about it, I said, "Will you drink tea?" And he was absolutely taken aback. And he said nothing, just stared at me. And I thought, well, he hasn't said no. So I sent out and had tea brought in. And I invited him to drink. He still said nothing, he still looked at me, and he still didn't drink, and I thought, have I made a mistake? And then he said, "Have you got pencil and paper?" And I said, "Yes." And I passed the pencil and paper across the table to him, and I watched him write rather laboriously, and then he passed it back to me, and I read what he'd written. It was just three words. "Is this poison?" I took up the same paper and I wrote, "This is a hospital. We are here to save life, not destroy it. Your tea's quite safe." And he looked at me another peer in that, and then he picked up his cup. And that changed the atmosphere.
What had been the tenor of his remarks before that?
Oh, just very, very official. Very official, very brusque. You do this, you don't do that, or else.
Yes, what was the communication?
Oh, in English.
He was giving you instructions.
Yes. We were not to attempt any sort of sabotage. We were not to attempt anything that would be detrimental to the Japanese who were in occupation or who happened to be in that particular area. We must just behave ourselves and realize that we were defeated and that we were now in their hands. And that's what I had to tell the hospital. I'm quite sure that at the beginning we were far too exhausted to take in just what had happened. Mm. And that now, remember, for the first time in history, for the first time since the beginning of time, a group of Britishers were in the hands and at the mercy of an Oriental power who had a grim reputation for ruthlessness. Some of us knew what had happened in say, places in China where the Japanese had taken over and their troops just ran wild.
Did the communication at this stage also include what the fate of the people at the hospital was going to be?
As far as I could gather, they had no intention of doing anything but doing the decent thing by them. He was a doctor, and I think that made a lot of difference. And after this incident that I've related, somehow we began to talk quite easily and normally. And he finished by putting down in Japanese characters some of the things that he'd been saying to me, and the fact that he'd been there, and the fact that he had left me in charge, that, I gathered, was the gist of what he'd put down in Japanese characters. And then he stamped it with his own seal, which indicated that he must have been somebody of standing, because they were the people who had their seals. And he said to me, "Well, I'm going now. The take-up party may be sometime before they get here. Meanwhile, you're in charge. But if you have any other people coming into this hospital or troubling you, show them this." And actually, that's what happened. We did have other people coming in the early days. That's what the Japanese did. They were roaming all over the place. Look, see, here, there, everywhere. And we had some gangs in who were a pretty rough lot. But this paper that I had somehow worked magic. And when I showed them this, they sort of calmed down and left us alone. What was on it, I don't know to this day.
What was the next stage, as far as you were concerned, after the period in the hospital?
There was a period when we were all left to our own devices, whilst the Japanese made up their minds what to do. And then, I believe it was January the 4th, they issued that order. We've got the paper here somewhere. Mm. Calling everybody to the Murray Parade Ground. And we went there expecting that we'd be told where we were going, what sort of preparations to take, and when to come again, sort of to march off. Instead of which, we discovered that we were in the bag already, that we were actually beginning our imprisonment at that moment. Because we were marched off from the Murray Parade Ground through the streets of Hong Kong, which was rather a humiliating experience with the Chinese looking on, although I must say from their expressions, from the look on their faces, we knew that their sympathies were with us. And they took us to a series of low-down waterfront dives, a combination of hotel and brothel, they actually were, used mainly by the crews of the chicken boats which plied between the colony and the mainland of China. And these were the places where they pushed us in for the beginnings of our imprisonment. We'd no idea what was going to happen. Nobody said anything about this is going to be a temporary business or this is going to be a permanent business. The only thing that we knew was that they were the filthiest places we'd ever seen in our lives. They were made up of cubicles, about 8 feet by six. A Chinese wooden bed in each room, and four people were pushed into each room, which was pretty bad overcrowding in a small place like that. And there were 150 people to each block of cubicles, men, women and children mixed up without any attempt at segregation of any sort. And the only toilet accommodation we had for those 150 people were two of the filthiest toilets you've ever seen in your life. The only way that we could manage was to sit sideways on the bed, lean your head and shoulders against the wall, try to find something to rest your feet on the floor to save them dangling and to save the tensions. And that's how it all started. And of course nobody knew how long it was going to happen. For 2 days they provided no food at all. The only food we got with the aid of the Chinese vendors with their cooking stalls, which are of course a feature of Hong Kong at any time. And they also got food to us until the Japanese began to get small supplies of food into us. We were in there for 16 days and nights. Although, as I say, the mental cruelty was that we'd no idea how long it was going to be. People were already saying, well, if this is it, we're not going to be here very long. We shan't be able to enjoy this very long. And then it all happened and changed rather unexpectedly. They came in one day and they said, well, out you go. And we were formed up and marched back again along the waterfront to one of the jetties. And there we were put into boats and towed to Stanley. Fortunately, the boats were so overcrowded that had the sea been at all rough, we should have had a very serious time, because the waters there can be very rough. Providentially, that very day, the water was as calm as I've ever seen it. And as soon as we followed the coast, we knew that's where we're off. We're going to Stanley, that's where the prison is.
These various moves from the hospital to the dives, as you called them, and finally to Stanley, were sudden. Had you been given any opportunity to collect any personal belongings to take with you?
That was the tragedy. That was the price we paid for being the first group to fall into Japanese hands. After our experience, we understand that that's what they did in other places, particularly Shanghai that you've mentioned. They were allowed to go back home, get certain essentials together, come back again, and they started their prison camp from there. We started from Murray Parade Ground with what we happened to have with us. Some, being wise, thought maybe this is going to be the beginning of things, and they brought certain things with us. Others were just as I am now, with not a thing except what you happen to have in your pocket. Mm.
Had the brothel area been cleared of its usual occupants before you moved in?
When the surrender of Japan took place, these people fled. They all tried to get into free China. That's where they went, because they were scared to death of the Japanese. They knew what they'd done in South China.
And during that period in the dive area, apart from the problems of food that you've mentioned, were there any, and overcrowding, were there any others? I'm thinking about health or...
Deterioration began even in that short time, because with the conditions, overcrowding, mostly in the dark, because all electricity had been cut off, and the only rooms in those blocks of cubicles with any light at all were the two end ones. They were the only ones with windows. The rest were in complete darkness until we got candles smuggled in. And as I say, it was verminous, it was flea-ridden. The food arrangements were appalling. The sanitary arrangements were terrible, unthinkable. And when I come to look back on that, I can't imagine how any nation, considering itself to be a civilized nation, could deal with prisoners, not its troops, its civilian prisoners, who were the victims of all this, in that barbaric way. It was an indictment that the Japanese will never get over.
What were your expectations at this stage, before you actually moved to Stanley? I mean, had the subject of internment arisen? Was it in your mind? What were you expecting?
We were so absolutely shattered and shocked by the conditions in the hotels that I don't think people were capable of thinking of anything, only what was happening at that particular moment. It was only when we got out to sea and realised we were on our way to Stanley, it was only then that we realised, well, this is it, this is where we're going to be. We knew Stanley. Actually, we thought we were going to be in the prison there, which was a new complex of very well-built modern buildings and would have been just the place for us. That, of course, never happened. Also at Stanley, and in the prison compound generally, there were the quarters which were used by the European warders, the quarters used by the Indian warders, because they had a big squad of Indian warders there from India, as well as our own Europeans. And in the same area, strangely enough, that there was the best and the highest ranking Chinese Boys' College in Hong Kong, administered by the Anglican Church in Hong Kong, known as St. Stephen's Boys College. And they had their school, their assembly hall, their classrooms, and they also had a big residential block made up of very, very well-appointed cubicles, nicely furnished. And actually, that was the place to make for if you had had former information as to where you were going. Those who got to St. Stephen's were the lucky ones. Those who got elsewhere weren't. But that is what was on the site. Mm. The important thing being that it's about the healthiest place in Hong Kong, almost entirely surrounded by the sea, connected to the mainland by just a narrow causeway. The Japanese didn't put it there because they thought it would do us any good. It was just that it was the easiest place for them, first of all, to administer, and from which it was almost impossible to escape. But no doubt, it was one of the main factors in our ultimate survival, the fact that we were in such a healthy place, because we escaped all the epidemics which happened in Hong Kong and which did a lot of damage. We had no epidemic. We came near to it on one occasion, but just avoided it, and that was part of our salvation.
Before you actually got to Stanley, and before your fate was made known to you, had the prospect of repatriation been a possibility?
Not at that time. It came up later on, as I can explain later. Mm-hmm. But perhaps I can go on to say this. When we arrived at Stanley, we thought that some plan would have been made by the Japanese as to billeting.
I'd like to hear in a little more detail about that actual move from the dive area to Stanley itself, because there was quite a large number of people to be interned, and it must have been, and you were, it was at almost no notice. Can you tell me how the actual physical move from the dive area to Stanley, what the scene was? Just describe it as a little story.
Well, as I have said, we were marched off from Murray Parade Ground in groups.
This move?
Yes. Mm. Yes, well, we were taken out of the dives group by group, and marched again along the waterfront to one of the main jetties. And there we found quite a number of boats awaiting us. And whilst we were there, it's a fairly big compound, that jetty, we intermingled with one another and exchanged conversations about what had happened to them, what had happened to us. And we found we'd all had just about the same experience. Whichever set of dives we'd been in, they were all filthy, they were all overcrowded, they were all dark, there'd been no sort of preparation for us, hardly any food provided, and everybody had had a shocking time. So we met together there, intermingled there, but enjoyed being in the open air and found how wonderful it was to breathe clean air again after all the filth in the dungeons where we'd been. Then we were embarked.
Now this must have been quite the embarkation.
It was. And as I say, if the waters hadn't been calm, it could have been a major disaster. But the waters were dead calm, and although the boats were overladen, top-heavy, we accomplished the voyage just along the coast without incident and offloaded at the jetty, there is a jetty there, at Stanley, just below the prison. And there must have been well over 2,000 of us. The ultimate nominal roll of the camp, which I have here, indicated that when we were all there, some came in penny numbers afterwards, when we were all there, there were 3,078 of us. But when we offloaded at Stanley, there'd be probably about, say, 2,500 or 600, expecting a billeting plan. An advanced party had been sent to make certain preparations, but they'd had to spend all their time burying the many dead which they found there. And that had taken up, they had no time to do anything with regard to preparing for our coming. Actually, it wouldn't have made any difference if they had, because there were far more of us turned up to be accommodated than the Japanese had told them about, and any plan that they had already made would have been useless. Consequently, as soon as this became known to the assembled multitude there, everybody took the law into their own hands and made one dash for the accommodation which was available. The warders' quarters, the Indian quarters, St. Stephen's Boys' College. And it depended upon how fleet of foot you were as to whether you got into anything, or if you were slow off the mark, as many of them were, they found themselves with nothing. And long after the accommodation was reported to be full and couldn't take any more, there were still hundreds adrift. And then the Japanese guards took over, and very ruthlessly. They just opened door after door and shoved in as many as they could shove in, men, women and children, until they'd found a place for somebody somewhere. And when darkness fell that night, that same night, there were men, women and children, many of whom had never seen or met each other before, all jumbled together in the same rooms. No attempt at all at segregation, no attention paid to age, sex or anything like that. Just one confused mess. And the trouble was that although the Japanese allowed us to make a few adjustments in the rooms which were obviously very chronically overcrowded, that is how the camp remained, more or less, through the 3.5 years which followed.
What happened to you personally?
An amazing thing. My wife and I, because we had other commitments in connection with the hospital and that sort of thing, were among the last of the boats going to Stanley. Consequently, when she and I got there, the place was like bedlam, absolutely like bedlam. I said to the first friend I met, where'd you go from here, you know? Is there any billeting plan? He said, Ernest, you must be joking. He said, there's nothing here, only confusion. I said, well, where shall I start looking? He said, you tell me. He said, this place is jam full. He said, you happen to hope. That's what he said. I said to my wife, you stay here and don't move. This is where I shall come back. And I'll take a look for myself. Went through the various rooms, same answer everywhere, and by this time folk were very bad-tempered, very restive, upset, sort of, if they didn't say get lost or something like that, they said something even worse. Couldn't find a thing. And with the warders' quarters, they had accommodation for the Chinese servants which they had, which were known as armour rooms. And they were rooms about the length of this and about half the width. They were the
rooms.
See,
that's about, 12 by 5?
Yes, something like that. They were the rooms that people were avoiding at first. Afterwards, they became the ones that everybody wanted to get into because they were the only places where people could be on their own. Well, I went through that camp, room by room, place by place, and I came to the very last door, which was an armour room. And the door was locked, and I thought, yes, same story. I shall have to go back to Mary and tell her we'll have to sleep under the stars or something tonight until we sort ourselves out tomorrow. And was just about to move off when something impelled me to go back again. I tried the same technique, knocked on the door, no answer, tried it, locked. Turned away again, and then something told me to put my hand and feel on the lintel over the top. You'll not believe this, but it's true. There was a key. And I unlocked the door, and there was an empty room with just an iron bed frame in, nothing else, a couple of boards, that's all. Absolutely empty, except that. I locked it, raced back to my wife, and I said, found a place. And we took up residence. I met my friend the next morning. He says, "Where did you sleep, Ernest?" I said, "In an armour room." He said, "You're telling me." He said, "Don't give me that." I said, "It's true." He said, "People have gone through this place with a fine comb before you came." I said, "Somebody must have known I was in need." I said, "That's what we've got. That was our home for the next 3.5 years.
Someone was looking after
you. And
your
that's
interests.
How we got it. You tell me. You tell me."
How quickly did you begin to organise yourself in the face of all this confusion?
Well, after 36 hours, when we realised that nobody seemed to be doing anything, or nobody from the Japanese side taking over and giving orders, we called everybody together in an open-air meeting, and there and then we had the first of our elections. And we elected a committee and gave them the responsibility of trying to contact the Japanese authorities and the responsibility of trying to get some sort of order into the place. And I was one of those elected onto that committee. We called it the Temporary Camp Council. We had a regular series of elections after that, properly conducted by our legal people in the camp. And I survived all those elections. Actually, I was the only one who did.